Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies, we'll reach in there, we'll pull the baby out, clip the cord, but not in a creepy way.
Oh, no. That's creepy just hearing it.
Awkward.
Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother James.
And tonight, we're going to talk about the 1999 movie Dogma, written and directed by Kevin Smith. But first, I think we have a little housekeeping.
Yeah, so I listened to the Dr. Strangelove podcast this afternoon, and for some reason it dawned on me that I have not mentioned one of the items that I've written down about Dr. Strangelove, and I didn't cross it off my list. So to go back to last week and talk about Failsafe, which you and I, we touched on Failsafe, like, was coming out about the same time as Dr. Strangelove. But Kubrick was worried that it was going to step all over him, so he filed a lawsuit against the studio saying that they stole the story from him. So it had the desired effect. It delayed it long enough that it ended up pushing the movie out so that Kubrick was able to get what he wanted out of it.
Did they just delay? I mean, did once they got their movie out, did they just drop the suit, or what happened?
I'm not sure. My impression is that the suit just didn't go anywhere, that they didn't have enough merit to continue.
But as a stall tactic, that's kind of devious.
Yeah, but totally sounds like something Kubrick would do.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't know how you say it either, but I don't know how to say most names, so it'll work out just fine.
Yeah, nuclear.
No, it's even names are hard.
Yeah.
But anyway. So, tell me about Failsafe. Or was that just the comment that we didn't talk about?
I haven't seen it. And unfortunately, I hate when stuff like this happens. I was like, I need to search for it on my cable DVR, because then I can, because I can search for the next, 4 weeks of stuff. And it was on AMC, but I had missed the first hour and a half of it.
And was it the 68 version, or was it the 2000 version?
Yes. It was the 68 version.
Because the 68 version was a theatrical release, right?
Right.
And the 2000 version was a television movie, but it was done live, and it was also done in black and white.
I had no idea. You mentioned it, but I haven't had a chance to look it up yet. So.
Oh yeah, it's got some great folks in it, and it's worth watching. It may not be worth us talking about on the podcast necessarily, but it's definitely worth watching. So,
Noah Wiley, Brian Dennehy. Well, there's a lot of people in that.
Oh yeah, it keeps going. How about wow. Don Cheadle, right?
Harvey Keitel.
Oh yeah, it's got everybody.
Hank Azaria.
Yep.
Why were they prompted to remake it?
I don't know. I guess the short answer is I have no idea. But it is a powerful story. It's exactly the same story as Dr. Strangelove without the satire. It's all a dead serious story.
Because by that point in 2000, the Cold War was ostensibly over anyway. So.
Oh, it's nostalgia. I'm sure it's Cold War nostalgia. Because it was 2000, it wasn't 2001. We had no idea that was the best of times.
All right. Well, I can't deny that.
I mean, isn't that, I don't know about you, that's kind of how I feel. Like we lived through the best of times and didn't realize it. Like the 80s through 2000 was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we got spoiled, for sure.
So any other housekeeping before we launch into Dogma?
Not that I can think of. So, did you watch this on Netflix, or did you have the DVD? Do you have the collector's DVD? How did you?
I have the DVD. I did not watch any of the extra features, though. I just watched the movie.
Okay. I'm three quarters of the way through the special features, but there's so much deleted stuff.
Well, I was going to ask you, do you think Kevin Smith is simply the fat Henry Rollins?
I'm not entirely sure how to answer that.
Okay, let me ask it a different way. It occurred to me, philosophically, I kind of like being the person on this podcast who just watches the movie. I like looking at the trivia and on IMDb or Wikipedia And I like looking for connections between actors and directors and that kind of thing. But I kind of like it that you are the guy that watches this, all the special features, because you're going to do that anyway. So I intentionally went into it realizing that there are probably a ton of special features and also a ton of interviews and speeches and things, because Kevin Smith is everywhere. I mean, that's why I think Kevin Smith is film's Henry Rollins. He's hip, he's respected in his field, and he's very opinionated, and he's not afraid to share those opinions.
Yeah, I would say that that's probably pretty accurate. There was probably another hour of movie footage. He's kind of the David Lynch of his generation, I think.
Yeah, well, he's a good filmmaker. I like his movies.
Well, I don't like all of his movies, but for the most part, and I don't always like his choices, but he seems funny enough at times, and he's hilarious at times. Sometimes I have to just kind of cast that little distant skepticism, because I'm not sure if he's trying to be ironic or if he's just trying to be like the lowest of lowbrow. Sometimes it's both, but.
Well, and I'm guessing that he would admit, or he would agree with you, that he doesn't like his movies all the time either, or some of the choices that he's made.
Well, and he said that in the DVD. He said, you know, sometimes I'm so into it that, you know, other people have to tell me that it's crap.
Yeah, well, and that's why you need editors, and that's why you need, you know, that frankly, that's why you need producers, because they sometimes can force you to make the tough decisions.
Yeah. So, there was an hour of film footage that they had to cut. So they had to cut some scenes. They cut some scenes entirely. They abbreviated other scenes. So, I've been watching some of that. Some of it was telling. Some of it was story that's lost, and some of it, wasn't necessary.
Well, was some of it strictly for the MPAA? So that they could submit it and then cut those bits that they didn't really need anyway and call it a concession?
From what I saw, no. None of it would have been rating, influential. It wouldn't have had any influence on the rating. It was more plot and substance, and it was just something like they had a whole scene with Bethany about her past. And so that explained a whole bunch about her backstory, which doesn't turn out to be all that necessary in the film. It was nice to see the story on the deleted scene, but, you know, the movie didn't lose anything in the movie by not having it in there.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Well, shall we?
You would have liked to have had it in the movie, but.
Shall we just dive right into the plot then?
Yeah.
Okay. So the movie starts off, by the way, this is Dogma 1999, written and directed by Kevin Smith. Plots, as always, provided by Wikipedia. Wikipedia. We're almost right. So the story begins with an old homeless man played by Bud Cort. And do you recognize Bud Cort or his name?
No.
He was Harold from Harold and Maude.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so an old homeless man, Bud Cort, is standing outside a skee-ball arcade in New Jersey and is beaten into a coma by three hockey stick-wielding teenagers who are referred to as the Stygian triplets. I had to look up Stygian. It's from the River Styx.
Oh?
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So, and there's a lot of weird mythologies thrown in here together. And not just Catholicism, but lots of, like, I don't understand why one of the angels' name is Loki. Was Loki?
Well, Bartleby and Loki, who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway. So, we have two fallen angels, Bartleby, Ben Affleck, and Loki, Matt Damon, who were banished from heaven. Well, I actually had to stop and jot a note down. Is there any better buddy team than Affleck and Damon?
If there is, I'm not aware.
Yeah.
And if there is, I don't want to know.
I mean, I'll watch those guys together do anything. You know?
Well,
no, I mean, you know what I mean. Not in a creepy way. I mean, they obviously like one another and they play well off of each other.
Yeah, I think they're a good pairing. So, I am with you there. I understand what you're saying. And I agree.
And as it turns out, they're both really good actors.
Yeah. I think I like, Batman notwithstanding, because I haven't seen, you know, we don't know what the Affleck Batman's going to be like yet, but, you know, I really dug the Bourne movie, so I kind of like Matt Damon as Jason Bourne, so
well,
I can see them both as action stars, but...
And what about Ripley?
Well, is Ripley? Oh, yeah. No, he was great. No, I like Matt Damon. I like most of Matt Damon's work. I don't think there's many Matt Damon movies I've seen that I haven't liked. In fact, I can't think of one I didn't like. But I mean, I don't seek him out as a movie catalog item, though. I mean, I don't. In my library, it's not like I see every Matt Damon movie that existed.
True, and I don't know what his filmography looks like compared to Affleck's filmography, as far as how many acting credits he has. It seems like he's either made better choices, or had better offers, or maybe has just done fewer films so that, you know, Ben Affleck's done a lot of movies, some of which are great, and some of which are crap.
Yeah, I liked Argo. That was Affleck recently, so. Yeah.
Well, The Town was fantastic. If you haven't seen The Town is really worth seeing. We'll have to do The Town. The Town is pretty great. It's kind of a caper movie.
All right, I like caper movies.
Yeah.
Is it a modern setting or?
Yeah. It takes place in Boston, and it definitely has his sort of Good Will Hunting kind of Boston as a character in the movie.
Okay, good to know.
Anyway, and he directs it, so it is really good. Yeah, but I don't know. I like both guys, and I like them also in Kevin Smith movies too. Like, you know, I like Chasing Amy. I thought that was a perfectly good movie.
Yeah, Chasing Amy was good.
And I'm trying to think of some other. Ben Affleck was in some of those indie kind of movies around that time too. But this isn't the Ben Affleck show. Anyway, we have Affleck and Damon as two fallen angels, Bartleby and Loki. And we find out that they were banished from heaven after an inebriated Loki, with Bartleby's encouragement, resigned as the Angel of Death. They're both exiled to Wisconsin, but they see their salvation when a church in Red Bank, New Jersey, celebrates its centennial anniversary with a plenary indulgence. They can have their sins forgiven by passing through the doors of the church and, upon death, regain access to heaven. Now, this seems like a wonderful plan. But we find out that there's one flaw in this plan.
Just one little flaw.
Yeah. Apparently, by doing this, they are overruling the word of God and therefore destroying all existence.
Which seems a little silly, but...
Yeah, well, the whole thing is, you know, I mean, this is a comedy, obviously. And it's supposed to be a biting social satire. But ultimately, it has to work as a comedy, right?
Yeah. I mean, it had lots of laughs. I mean, there's lots of funny lines in this movie. And there's some subtle things in here that are, you know, there's some subtle things, but there's also a fair bit of social commentary and church commentary. And it's clear that Kevin Smith is not a fan of the Catholic Church.
Well, now, is he a practicing Catholic still?
I doubt it.
I want to think that he is. I want to think that I read somewhere that he still, like, tithes and goes to church and everything.
Huh, well, maybe.
So he would have given like his 10% of his income from dogma to the Catholic Church.
Well, that would be kind of hilarious.
Then we meet one of our other main characters, Bethany Sloan, played by Linda Fiorentino. She is an abortion clinic worker. She attends a sermon in which donations are collected for the hospital bills of the homeless man that we saw earlier, who has been beaten into a coma and is now on life support. There's no documentation of him or living relatives, so he's simply known as John Doe Jersey. What do you think of Linda Fiorentino?
As Bethany?
Yeah, well, generally, or as Bethany.
She was okay. I mean, she's recognizable, but I couldn't identify what else she's been in. I mean, I know I've seen her in other works. She was okay. Part of me gets the impression that this may have been... And I'm making this up. But I kind of could totally see like Janine Garofalo in this role.
Oh, did they not in the other things? Did they not have the Kevin Smith quote about this?
No.
Okay, well, you nailed it. Kevin Smith on his DVD commentary apparently said that she was really difficult to work with, and wouldn't even talk to him some days. So in hindsight, he thought, well, he just should have given the role to Janine Garofalo and called it a day.
Oh, wow. Oh, well, good for me.
Exactly, yeah.
Because she was really difficult to work with, huh?
Apparently.
Huh. I don't...
And she
was the star. She was the main character. What? Oh, I don't know.
Oh, I don't know either. And again, who knows, but she hasn't really worked a lot. I don't know whether that's family-related stuff or whatever, but, you know, she was really, from The Last Seduction, you know, she had that gritty kind of, how to describe it? She was like, she has like a sexual energy without being the prettiest girl in the room. Does that make sense?
Yeah, she's not drop-dead gorgeous. I mean, she's kind of classically beauty. Classically beautiful. But I mean, she's not a 10 or anything, but I mean, she's not ugly.
I'm sure in real life she's simply divine looking, but yeah, it just, she's not, you know, a blonde California bimbo style. So in like The Last Seduction, it really worked very well. She wasn't a female character who would is going to be walked on. And then she did that unfortunate movie, Jade, I think, with David Caruso, and that didn't help either of their careers.
No, I vaguely remember what was horrible about that movie. Everything.
Well, I don't remember it enough. It was by me at least forgettable. But it was in that period where we had The Last Seduction and also Basic Instinct, and then there people tried to capitalize off of those things, and you get things like Sliver. And you get things like Jade, and I'm trying to think of some other things about that time that might as well have been, you know, those like Skinamax type movies. Like Basic Instinct was a full on great movie with a Skinamax type plot.
I dug Sliver, by the way. I liked Sliver.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it recently at all, so I just remember it being kind of forgettable.
I haven't seen it either, and I have this sinking suspicion if I were to go back and rewatch it that it would be terrible.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean, we've run into that before here.
Yeah, and so I haven't rewatched it. I don't own it, so that's one obstacle, of course. But I did read recently that Sharon Stone and Mr. Baldwin had such a horrible, contentious reality about the two of them during the filming of the movie that at one point she bit his tongue so hard that he couldn't talk for 3 days on set.
Excellent. See, and Kevin Smith bitches about Linda not talking to him for a couple of days. Yeah, could have had it worse.
I don't know why she would be difficult, but you know, who knows why actresses or actors are difficult. You know, Kevin Smith also had that, he said Mr. Bruce Willis was very difficult to work with.
That's true. That's true.
Bruce Willis said he was an asshole that needed to grow up.
Well, and it's funny because Kevin Smith has been doing a lot of interviews lately to promote his movie Tusk. And so he's ended up on podcasts that I normally listen to. And I don't normally listen to this modcast. I've heard several of them and it's fine. But there's just so much of it and it's so personal that I don't really necessarily need to hear the funny story about his pool being built. But he was on The Nerdist, I think, and he was talking about how, you know, he didn't even, like, I guess, smoke pot before, like, Clerks or anything. But fairly recently, he's, like, total wake and baker. I mean, he smokes pot all day long. And he says that it's one of those things that it doesn't help his creative process at all, but it just tame some of the stuff that gets in the way. And I think part of what may get in the way is he probably has a fairly short fuse as well.
You know, I'm
sure when you're a director on a film, and I would only have to imagine because I have no real idea, but you know, you're dealing with time, and time is money, big money in a lot of cases. So little things can destroy your shooting schedule. And I think that would be very frustrating.
Well, and also as a creator, I imagine, you know, he has a vision as to what he expects that the talent is going to do, not realizing, and it's hard to let go of that because you have so many variables that you can't control all those variables. So you have to give up a lot of control and allow the actors and actresses to be themselves or be the characters that they can be in. That kind of mitigated chaos is probably, you know, it's probably nerve-wracking because you have to, you know, basically somebody's acting a way that they're acting and may not line up with how you envisioned it, but that's just kind of what you get.
Well, and also you've got producers who are saying, you know, you can't actually film this in New York. We have to film this in Toronto. Or you have to cut that scene where everybody goes to Spain because you don't have enough money to pay for that scene. So now we're going to do all that in a flashback scene or maybe some kind of voiceover. Did you see the documentary Kurt and Courtney?
No.
Well, I think it's Nick Broomfield is the guy's director's name, and he's an odd duck, let's say, as a documentary filmmaker. But he interviewed a bunch of people, you know, from Kurt Cobain's life, and he theorizes that Courtney Love killed him or had him killed. Actually, he interviews a guy who claims to have been the hitman. But anyway, during one really great scene in the beginning, and it's the first I remember clearly watching it at the Capri Theater. And hearing this line and being completely like tickled and amazed that you could just do this. But at one point, after talking to like Kurt Cobain's school teacher of some kind, who also like she played acoustic guitar, you know, she looked kind of like a youth pastor sort of person. And she was talking all about how little Kurt was very talented and, you know, it's a shame and all this stuff. And then the director says, in his, you know, his inimitable, at least by me, English accent, he's like, and this is the part where I was going to play some of Kurt Cobain's early songs. But his estate, Courtney Love, the person of one Courtney Love, refused to allow him the rights. So instead, he's just going to play a song by somebody who knew Kurt that just wrote a song, just it has nothing to do with the story, but he's going to insert that in here. But the fact that he says that, like in his own dialogue, in his own documentary, is
fantastic.
It's just funny. It's like, wait, you can do that? You can just say, well, my vision of this film was something completely different, but this is what we have to deal with. So, follow me, people.
That's brilliant.
I mean, it's kind of breaking the fourth wall, even though it is a documentary.
No, I respect that though.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. Like I said, I remember it. So back to this movie, because this movie has a lot of fun, fun people.
I was going to say we've gone far, far afield, but before we put the car back on the road, so they still speculate that Courtney Love tried to have him killed, except that the police report, I don't know if you saw, because now the police have brought it up again because it's the anniversary, and it's, but had he not shot himself, he would have died anyway.
Oh, from the heroin in the system?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's, I mean, it's not funny at all. Yeah, the guy was super troubled. And if you want to know how long it's been, his daughter is an adult now.
No.
Hey, back to the movie. We're all getting old. Yeah, so back to the movie. So later that day, we meet one of my favorite characters in this movie, and that's Metatron, who is the voice of God. And he is played by Alan Rickman.
That's fantastic casting, by the way.
I love Alan Rickman. He is so... He's super talented, but he's also very funny.
He plays a very good kind of straight man like that.
And he's got this, like, withering looks that are hilarious. But he appears to Bethany, and he is the voice of God, so he's... Basically, and he appears with you in a big like wall of flame, because that's how in the Old Testament God is usually seen, as this big wall of flame with the voice. But she, of course, grabs a fire extinguisher and puts him out. Now, it's worth noting that all of the angels or other like angelic figures are all wearing the same clothing, just different colors. Like they all have these hoodies. But they're all different color hoodies.
I hadn't really noticed that.
And I think it was actually a design choice to pick the hoodies because the hoods represented their halos.
Oh, see, that's brilliant, though.
But so if you go back and look at it, everybody who's supposed to be an angel has a hoodie on. So
that's pretty brilliant. I hadn't noticed that, but now I'll definitely have to.
Yeah, it's the little things. And there are a lot of these little things in the whole movie. But so Metatron appears to Bethany, and they have a whole conversation about how why pick her, because, you know, she doesn't she's having a crisis of faith anyway.
Not exactly thrilled to be included in any of this in any way.
No, but she is a Catholic, and she goes to church, even though she works in an abortion clinic, and she lost her faith in God due to her infertility, for which her husband divorced her. So is there anything in the deleted scenes that illuminates that whole picture, or does it really matter at this point?
Well, like I said, there's a whole entire scene about her counseling a young girl, because the young girl's had like the third abortion, and she's talking about, you know, and the woman's like giving her grief. And so Bethany talks about her story about, you know, how she got pregnant and her husband wanted her to keep it. And what happened was she didn't want to keep it because she wanted them to both get through school, and she couldn't, so she knew that she couldn't go and get an abortion conventionally because her husband's mother was like watching all the abortion clinics because she was kind of a protester. So she went to this like college botched abortion, thing, and that ended up leaving her sterile. So it was a botched abortion. And she told her husband, you know, that she'd miscarried, which turns out she did miscarry because of the botched abortion, but that's what ended up resulting in the infection, which left her unable to have children, in which she was like, I need a divorce because I'm going to only be with a woman who can bear my children.
Which, that's a heavy load to add to this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I could totally see why they cut that.
Yeah, no, it was a long scene, and it was a good scene, but yeah, that scene was from a very different movie.
Yeah, and it seems like too on the nose as far as the message.
It was a little too ham-handed for Kevin Smith.
Well, and yeah, and it's just a straight-up F you to the church, and that, you know, this movie was already protested. I mean, there's a whole story we're going to tell, I'm sure, at some point, about how this movie was protested before it even came out.
And this is a violent movie, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, this is not a movie for kids. It's a comedy, but it's not
for
kids.
There's a lot of death in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Just wanton death, too. I mean, you know, but...
Yeah, but you know, it's tension and release, tension and release. This is no Take Shelter. This is a comedy.
That's your new 2001, is it?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. Even though, as it turns out, I think I like Take Shelter also, because I like 2001, as it turns out. I just have some problems with it. Anyway, yeah, I'll probably harp on that for about a dozen episodes, and then we'll move on to some other movie.
Well, it's okay. I mean, I find it amusing.
Yeah, well, I'm far too suspicious of why Drew picks movies. You could easily punish me because I'm not quite expecting it from you, and I don't know why. It's not, you know, I don't. There's nothing devious about his selections, but...
I could punish you. How would I punish you?
Oh, by picking a movie that I haven't seen that is like, say, a Dear Zachary sort of movie.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, see, but that only punishes me as well, though, because then I have to sit through it. And, you know, as fine a film as Dear Zachary is, and it is a fine film, it's a great film, it's not a movie you want to see on a weekday, and certainly, you know... It needs to be a strong day if you're going to watch that movie.
Well,
and I don't recommend it with like a double feature of like Schindler's List. So
yeah, it's not a date movie, and I also can't imagine watching it a second time. I just watching it a second time is not going to happen.
Yeah, I don't know what the motivation would be because
a little tangent here. I think with the new microphone setup, our talk over is more of an issue, but we'll just have to deal with that.
And now we have the ability, by the way, with Google Hangouts, you know, anybody who wants to join can.
That's true.
So if somebody wants to watch a movie that we're going to watch, because we have a calendar now, God knows we could publish the calendar somewhere.
Yeah, how does that work? How can we do that?
We might actually be able to import it somehow into Facebook, but I'll have to look into that. But at any rate, if anybody has any interest in movies joining in. There are some logistics that would have to be set up, obviously. We have to coordinate times. You know, we do this at a very specific time.
Yeah. Well, and we can actually just, I guess we can just simply put up a list, because with our calendar, it makes it easy to make that list.
Like, yeah, that's true too.
Like, one of the things that I like about the calendar is that we can have the either the conversation or just the thought about, oh, what do we want to do after the next couple movies or whatever, so that I can just put on my list, you know, at the end of my little notes for the episode, I'll just put next up The Fifth Element, which is, happens to be the one after this one, right? So anyway, okay, back to the movie. Since we're only on maybe, what, minute 5 of the movie? So, okay. So now we have Bethany now realizes she has a mission, although she's not excited about the mission and doesn't even necessarily believe. Because Metatron tells her, okay, you're going to meet these prophets and you're going to end up meeting some other people that are going to help you along the way. And your mission, by the way, is to prevent these angels from going through that church door in New Jersey. So she's then attacked by the Stygian triplets, but is saved by the prophets, Jay and Silent Bob. And, you know, Jay and Silent Bob are goofy characters, but this movie reminded me, you know, Jason Mewes is just his own little thing. So he's playing this whole Jay character. And Kevin Smith is so expressive in his Silent Bob thing. I mean, this is probably the movie that pointed out it as much as any of the movies that I've seen, where when they're together at the diner, and Kevin Smith is just making all those gestures and face movements in response to the conversation.
Right.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant stuff.
No, he is a force of nature. I mean, he has the ability to not speak, and actually by just his presence and his body language to say more than most of the people that have dialogue.
Oh, yeah, it's hilarious. And
which is an amazing talent.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I love the John Hughes speech.
So what's up? You have a friend for Silent Bob, or you can just do a spoil? If so, I'm first. I hate sloppy seconds.
You're a man of principle. Jersey's pretty far from McHenry. May I ask who brought you here?
Some fuck named John Hughes.
16 Candles, John Hughes?
You know that guy, too? That fucking guy. Made this flick, 16 Candles. Not bad, there's tits in it, but no bush. But Ebert over here don't give a shit about that kind of thing. Cause he's like all in love with this John Hughes guy. Goes out and rents like every one of his movies. Fucking Breakfast Club, where all these stupid kids actually show up for detention. Fucking Weird Science, where this babe wants to take her gear off and get down, but oh no, she don't, because it's a PG movie. And then Pretty in Pink, which I can't even watch with this tubby bitch anymore, because every time we get to the part where the redhead hooks up with her dream guy, he starts sobbing like a little bitch with a skin knee and shit. And there's nothing worse than watching a fucking fat man weep.
What exactly brought you to Illinois?
See, all these movies take place in this small town called Shermer in Illinois, where all the honeys are top shelf, but all the dudes are whiny pussies. Except for Judd Nelson, he was fucking harsh. But best of all, there is no one dealing, man. Then it hits me. We could live like fat rats if we were the Blunt Connection in Shermer, Illinois. So we collected some money we owed and caught a bus. But you know what the fuck we found out when we got there? There is no Shermer in Illinois. Movies are fucking bullshit.
Yeah, but I just thought it made me laugh when, you know, I always forget that, you know, Jay and Silent Bob are the prophets.
Oh, and they're so funny. I mean, the whole thing is they're so single-minded in their idiocy. So then we meet probably my least favorite character in the movie, which is the 13th Apostle Rufus, played by Chris Rock.
He's your least favorite character?
Well, only because he is just doing his Chris Rock thing.
Well, but he had important dialogue.
Oh, yeah. No, he was essential to the story.
So you disliked his performance because he was too much Chris Rock and not enough Rufus?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. But, I mean, and that's not even necessarily fair to him, because I think Rufus was just written as Chris Rock. But he definitely put on his Chris Rock voice, you know, his Chris Rock persona he has in stand-up. he was wearing that loud and proud.
Yeah, I think that was on purpose.
Yeah. Like I said, it's not his fault, and I like Chris Rock. It's fine. It's just that I think that his character, which was important to the story because he had a lot of exposition to talk about, and it is funny that he was left out of the Bible for being black, and he has the whole thing about Jesus being black. But you know, to me, there was just a lot of that kind of like Chris Rock stand up thing that kind of turned me off. And also, I didn't really like Selma Hayek. I mean, she was fine, but eh.
I really dug her.
Oh, you're allowed to. That's fine. Now, let's talk about Jason Lee. I happen to like Jason Lee quite a bit.
Me too.
I think in real life, he's a Scientologist and kind of a nut.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me.
But still, he's just so fun. I mean, even back when we talked about, remember a long time ago when we talked about the movie Big Trouble?
Yeah.
He was one of the better parts of Big Trouble. So even though he had the goofy horns as the demon Azrael, he warns Bartleby and Loki that the forces of heaven and hell are attempting to kill them, and Satan will not let them succeed where he has failed.
And he delivers one of the best lines of the movie.
No pleasure, no rapture, no exquisite sin greater than central air.
There's no greater sin than central air.
Yeah, he's hamming it up too. But again, all these characters. You know, another thing I was thinking about while watching this movie is how brightly lit Kevin Smith movies are. Lots of color choices. It's a very friendly film to look at.
It's very rich. It's very rich in color. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, almost like comic booky.
Yeah, that's a Kevin Smith thing.
Yeah, it's nice. It's very pleasant.
Yeah, because he's a comic book. I mean, that can't surprise you.
Oh no, not at all. But it does. But he just gives you this kind of like almost like a Walt Disney movie kind of color.
Well, I think that was a very conscious choice because, you know, the whole movie thing, the movie, the cow thing was a slap at Mickey Mouse.
Well, yeah, and also the golden calf from the Old Testament. But oh yeah, most definitely, yeah.
But what I'm saying is it was very much kind of a comic booky, cartoony kind of thing. And somewhat because some of the there are points in this movie where you could see elements of like Who Framed Roger Rabbit kind of extreme comic crossover animation happening that didn't happen. You know, like when Matt Damon shoots the people on the bus, you could have had the giant jaw dropping open and the giant gun. You know, you can see all those kind of elements that could have easily gone there had this been a different movie.
Do you realize that I've never seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
How is that possible?
Well, I mean, I know a lot about it. I just have never seen it.
We went, because we went, you weren't with us when we went and saw it?
No, that would be no.
We saw it at the Fireweed THX, which was, you know, that giant third movie theater they built, the giant, you know, you remember when they built that at the Fireweed, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was the one of the original, because Fireweed used to be three gigantic theaters, and then they turned it into 16, one big
right,
one.
Right, but I mean, but when they started, when they built the THX, it was just one gigantic theater.
Oh, definitely.
And that's where I saw it. I swear it was with you and Drew, but it's been so long I couldn't remember.
No, I'm pretty sure it was not with me and Drew. I mean, it may have been with Drew, but...
Yeah. For me, that wasn't a great movie. It was an okay movie, but it's not... Some people love that movie to death, but I'm just like, it was an okay movie. I mean, it's not on my top 10. It's not something that I have a burning desire to watch again. You know, it didn't resonate with me. It didn't, I mean, I remember bits and pieces of it, but not in any kind of like reverent way. It just is something that I've seen.
Eventually, I'm sure I'll have to watch it, but at this point, I watched Cool World. Does that make a difference? No, probably not. That was, the Cool World was Brad Pitt, Gabriel Byrne, and Alec Baldwin's wife. bad, huge divorce.
Oh, Kim Basinger.
Yes. Yes, Kim Basinger. Schwing. Okay, sorry. Lots of tangents in this whole discussion. But we, okay.
Yeah, we're really all over the place tonight, aren't we?
Yeah. So we've got the demon Azrael, Jason Lee, and his Stygian triplets, who are trying to... Well, ultimately, he wants the destruction of everything. But he's trying to play both sides against the middle. Then again, he's a demon, so that's not surprising either.
Right.
So Bethany's party unwittingly meet the angels on a train.
Which is kind of funny.
Oh, yeah. And it's hilarious because this is where, again, this is where Ben Affleck is actually using his acting skills. You know, Linda Fiorentino doesn't do a great job acting like she's drunk, I don't think. But
no.
He really does a good job reacting to what she's saying and realizing that, oh yeah, he is not, he's an unhappy man. An angel, sorry, he's not even a man. He realizes that she is the one who is out to stop them, and he is not amused with the whole situation. Unlike Loki, who, when he realizes that Ben Affleck is so serious, he sort of freaks out and says, no, hold on there. Maybe this was a bad idea to begin with.
Yeah, let's just go home.
Yeah, well, and again, Bethany tells Bartleby the whole plan. And he realizes that, this will cause this destruction that they hadn't counted on. But that's fine by him because he is a bitter, bitter angel.
Apostle is here. I noticed.
Well, then you know who the chick with him was, don't you?
I'm the scion, I imagine. Shit, man. Look, maybe we should rethink this whole thing. I mean, you heard the guy. He said there are consequences. And Azrael tells us we're marked. Look, man, there is more to this than we thought about.
I was close. You know, I was so close to just slitting that bitch's throat. You know how I felt? Righteous. Justified. Eager, even.
You all right, man? Your eyes are kind of...
My eyes are open. For the first time, I get it. When that little innocent girl let her mission slip, I had an epiphany. See, in the beginning, it was just us and him, angels and God. Uh-huh. Then he created humans. Ours was designed to be a life of servitude and worship and bowing and scraping and adoration. He gave them more than he ever gave us. He gave them a choice. They choose to acknowledge God or choose to ignore him. All this time we've been down here, I've felt the absence of the divine presence, and it's pained me, as I'm sure it must have pained you. And why? Because of the way he made us. Had we been given free will, we could choose to ignore the pain, like they do. But no, we're servants.
Okay. You know, all I'm saying here is that one of us might need a little nap.
Wake up! These humans have besmirched everything he's bestowed upon them. They were given paradise, they threw it away. They were given this planet, they destroyed it. They were favored best among all his endeavors, and some of them don't even believe he exists. And in spite of it all, he has shown them infinite fucking patience at every turn. What about us? I asked you once to lay down the sword because I felt sorry for them. What was the result? Our expulsion from paradise. Where was his infinite fucking patience then? It's not right. It's not fair. We've paid our debt. Don't you think it's time? Don't you think it's time we went home? And to do that, I think we may have to dispatch our would-be dispatchers.
Wait. Kill them? You're talking about the last scion, for Christ's sake. And what about Jay and Bob? I mean, those guys were all right.
Don't, my friend. See, don't let your sympathies get the best of you. They did me once. Scion or not, she's just a human. And by passing through that arch, our sins are forgiven. No harm, no foul.
My God, I've heard a rant like this before.
What did you say?
I've heard a rant like this before.
Why don't you fucking do that to me?
You sound like the Morning Star.
You shut your fucking mouth,
You sound like Lucifer, man! You fucking lost it! You're not talking about going home, Bartleby. You're talking about fucking war on God. Well, fuck that. I have seen what happens to the proud when they take on the throne. I'm going back to Wisconsin. We're going home, Loki. And no one, not you, not even the Almighty himself, is gonna make that otherwise.
You're right. His acting was pretty... I mean, you could see it in his face. You're right. The emotion was clear. And I also agree with you that I think Bethany was not a convincing drunk. She's a fine actress, but I don't think this was her best role. I don't think she did great in this role. And like I said, I think there was better people that could have done this.
Yeah. And I think the trivia that I found out about, him not really getting along with her, maybe influenced my opinion while looking at the thing again, because she does a fine job. It's just that, yeah, I guess it's when you regret what might have been.
Oh, I gotcha. And I try not to read that kind of stuff beforehand. So
exactly, like me too. I try not to, but in this case, I tried to make notes ahead of time, in the interest of time. Right. But maybe I should not be so interested in the interest of time, and more in the interest of experiencing the whole thing.
Well, I just, because my problem is, I like to be, if at all possible, I like to be surprised again by the movies when I watch them. And so I try just to go into it with as clean a slate as I can. For Gattaca, because I had been so long since I'd watched it, I'd forgotten the plot twists, which was fantastic, because then it was like watching a movie I hadn't seen before, even though.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I had forgotten how angry Bartleby is at the end of this movie.
No, he's...
Now, this is where the plot takes a turn for the serious, because now Bartleby realizes that there is a plot against him, and he is really threatened, and he's going to go through with this plan to destroy all of existence. And Loki is horrified at this. He's like, no, it's fine being the Angel of Death. And they're having a good time doing as many sins as they can before getting their indulgence and having their slate wiped clean. But even Loki decides, no, this is too much. But Bartleby is the stronger character, and so he basically forces Loki to continue their plan. And this is where we find out that Bethany is the last relative of Jesus Christ. She's the last scion. So the whole group is talking about the plan, and that's where Metatron explains that God goes to Earth in human form every now and again to play skee ball. And he's gone missing. Yeah, it's just, are there really skee ball alleys in New Jersey?
I have no idea. I've never been to New Jersey.
Well, me either. And the only place I've ever seen actual skee ball has been the Chuck E. Cheese.
And that would be the same for me.
Yeah.
The same Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah, indeed.
But I have to think, though, that Kevin Smith is, He is a creature of that part of the country. I imagine that is pretty accurate.
Apparently, God went down to play skee ball, and he's gone missing now. And that someone knew enough to incapacitate him, but leave him alive in a mortal form, and thus unable to return to heaven, and therefore deal with the whole Bartleby and Loki thing. Because you think God could just solve that with not too much work.
Right, but and that was alluded to several times.
Yes, but God is incapacitated in kind of a, it's sort of a contrived part of the plot, but you got to get from A to C somehow, so that happens to be the B. So because they decide that, okay, Lucifer has as much to lose if Bartleby and Loki succeed, I guess that doesn't even necessarily matter at this point. They just happen to come to that conclusion as well. But they go immediately to the church to talk to Cardinal Glick to cancel the celebration. And this conversation doesn't go very well. And Cardinal Glick is played by George Carlin in such a great way.
Yeah, because, George Carlin himself has a very, he didn't really appreciate religion as such when he was alive. So it's funny that now he's playing kind of the anti-Carlin.
Well, I think he's a Catholic too, or he was raised Catholic. So he, you know, again, this role may have very well been written for him.
Probably.
They basically get thrown out of Cardinal Glick's office saying, oh, he's not going to just cancel this ceremony. This is what this has all been about. And by the way, I still have two, count them two, statuettes of Buddy Jesus, one that glows in the dark, from this movie.
Why does it need to glow in the dark?
It just happens to be the version that glows in the dark. And then there's the one that's fully colored. It has to, I think there are some Virgin Mary statuettes that glow in the dark also for kids.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, that way the Virgin Mary is looking down upon you, looking out for you, keeping that monster deep under the bed.
Very strange world sometimes.
You know, whatever gets you through this crazy thing we call life. Okay, sorry. Back to focus on the movie again. And actually, we're getting kind of toward the end of the movie anyway, so all these tangents are not necessarily taking us too far astray. But everybody, of course, the final scene is going to end at this church. So there's a big celebration, and Bartleby and Loki reach the church, and Bartleby proceeds to kill everybody. And at a nearby bar, Azrael captures the heroes and explains that he masterminded this whole thing and that he wanted to destroy existence rather than spend eternity in hell. But he needed to manipulate Bartleby and Loki, because if Bartleby and Loki become human, like basically cut off their wings and become human and then die, they can go to heaven and that's how this whole thing happens. But as a demon, demons can't become humans again. Again, one of those plot things. So there's the fight at the bar where Silent Bob... By the way, Silent Bob is the hero in this entire story.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the one, and he actually has two spoken lines in the whole thing. But otherwise remains like the silent hero. So he kills Azrael with the blessed golf club, and then Serendipity, Salma Hayek's character, who's a muse with writer's block, tells Bethany to bless the sink. So she makes holy water out of the water in the sink, and they kill the Stygian triplets by dunking their heads into the water.
Because sanctifying is just one of the fringe benefits.
Apparently.
But I kind of liked the speech, though, that the banter that they were having before the fight took place, and how... Muse is giving Azrael crap, and that's why, talks about Elvis, and that's why he's the king and you're a schmuck.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of funny dialogue in this movie.
There was a lot.
And, like, I love the Jay character, too, because the Jay character is also single-minded. Like, Bob he's like Jay's sidekick. But he's also, again, he's the silent hero with the heart of gold. Jay is not necessarily the guy with the heart of gold. Jay is looking to get laid. To the very end, he's trying to get laid. But then mentions to Bethany during this whole fight at the church, when they finally go to the church. Oh, wait, sorry, I skipped ahead a little bit. When they get to the church, they've arrived before Bartleby and Loki have entered. Loki's wings have been torn off by Bartleby, so he's human. And quite drunk. So he decides to help them, but it doesn't matter because, in a really sweet kind of moment, Bartleby kills Loki.
Seeing you people every day on this perfect little world he created for you is a constant reminder that though my kind came first, your kind was most revered. Mm-hmm. And while you know forgiveness, we know only regret. Lesson must be taught. All are accountable. Even God.
Soon a cadre of police will arrive just in time to kill us as we exit the church. And then this failed experiment called existence will cease to be.
No, hey, hey! No, no. I can't let you do that, Bartleby. This has gone too far. I might have to take you down.
Okay.
I'll do it.
My compatriot. Genocide takes a lot out of him. He's weakened.
You're weak.
More importantly, he's also a human being. A condition which carries two liabilities. Conscience. And, short lifespan. I'm sorry, old friend. But you lost the faith.
Which, again, I think that's actually a credit to Affleck's character. You know, his acting ability.
I think it was sweet slash creepy.
Yeah, it was bittersweet, and yeah, exactly.
This is one part where the movie lost me. If they wanted to get in, why would they have waited to go through?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, because most everybody had been lain waste, or the waste had been lain, or however that works, by the time everybody gets there. But anyway, while ducking and keeping out of the way, Bethany's trying to hide, and Jay is basically taking off his clothes to sleep with her because now, basically, he's the last man on Earth or whatever, and the world was going to end, so now that she has to fulfill her promise to sleep with him. So he mentions the John Doe jersey guy, and she thinks, wait, this could be God. So they go to the hospital, and Bethany and Bob race to the hospital, and Jay ends up shooting off Bartleby's wings with a submachine gun, which turns him human, too. So Bethany removes John Doe jersey's life support, allowing God to escape. Unfortunately, Bethany herself dies in the whole thing. And then God manifests in the church before a very remorseful Bartleby. And God is...
Alanis Morissette.
And she does such a great job.
Absolutely.
She's just so cute.
Yeah.
And, you know, she had popped up throughout the movie and is always quiet because, of course, the reason why she has Metatron speaking for her is because humans would just fall down dead at the sound of God's actual voice. Which I kind of see as a Raiders of the Lost Ark ending kind of thing. So it seems to me plugging the ears wouldn't have helped everybody else. But, oh well, if that's what it's about, that's fine too.
Yeah, again, another plot thing. But way over the top head exploding kind of bad special effect.
Yeah, yeah. Again, like I said, I thought Ben Affleck did a great job in this movie.
Yeah.
And you know, it all ends in a cute way. And, of course, at the very end, not only does God resurrect Bethany, but also there's a child conceived inside her. And, oh, she also cleaned up the area in front of the church.
Yeah.
So, God, Rufus, Metatron, and Serendipity all return to heaven. And Bethany, Jay, and Bob are left to just reflect on what happened. So,
yeah.
What did we miss with the deleted scenes?
Again, I haven't finished all of them, but nothing that... I mean, it's just really extended stuff. There was nothing really so far that was even important. It was just more story, which is not bad, but it didn't. Its loss didn't really diminish the story as such.
Well, how long was this movie?
I wouldn't say it was 2 hours, but
yeah, maybe just two. I'm beginning to appreciate 97-minute movies.
It says 130 minutes on the box. So.
Oh, okay. So it is pretty long. Yeah. Which is fine. It didn't feel like it was long. It didn't drag at all.
No, it doesn't feel like, you know, sometimes you watch a movie and even if it's a good movie, watching it for that long, you realize, like, oh, that's a 2-hour movie. But this, yeah, you're right. This one didn't feel like it. I think probably because it moves a lot. It has a pretty steady pace, and it has enough to keep you laughing, in between the, you know, even the downtime, there's some funny stuff. There is a pretty hilarious deleted scene, which, it's ridiculous, where when they're Jay and Silent Bob are at the strip club and they beat the black guys out of their stripper contest for the Muse's attention. Turns out that the Black Men took great offense, and so they're basically gonna bust a cap in Jay and Silent Bob. And so Jay and Silent Bob get up and do a rap number version of Fat Albert.
Okay, that would have been interesting to see.
Which is Kevin Smith actually rapping and or doing the Fat Albert.
Like, hey, 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 that kind of?
Yes, yes.
Hey, what the fuck is you doing, white boy?
Sing it.
I'm gonna sing a song for you.
Hell yeah.
Jay's gonna show you a thing or two.
Newt to the nick to the newt, newt, newt.
You'll have some me and all the gang.
Represent, represent.
Learning from each other. How we do our thing.
She looked familiar.
Who?
Serendipity.
And so that I think it's too bad that didn't make it in the movie, but I suspect that audiences would have seen that as kind of a racist kind of Kevin Smith, you know. I think a lot of people would have taken it offensively. But I thought it was hilarious.
Well, he ends up apologizing to a lot of groups because, like, for instance, during the Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back movie, there's this whole subplot where Eliza Dushku and two other girls end up, I think one of them is Kevin Smith's actual wife, end up being like a group of lesbians who are out to, there's some nefarious plot they're doing. And he ended up having to, like, write Glad a $10,000 check to get that to stop protesting the movie because he portrayed lesbians in a bad light.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So it would be, you know, the whole he wouldn't want to have to write checks to Glad and the NAACP and the Catholic Church and, you know, on and on and on and on.
Yeah. I don't know why you would write checks anyway, but was it really that big a deal to have them protest his movie?
Well, he didn't think of himself as some homophobe and didn't want to have them, you know, spreading the word that he was homophobic. So he just thought it was easier to write a check than to keep explaining that that's not what it meant and that you're allowed to have a character who's gay and a bad guy.
Yeah.
Without being a homophobe.
Right. I agree.
I mean, by him telling that story, he basically says, look, you know, this is just extortion.
Yeah, see, that was where I was going with it. It's like, you're just paying your blackmailer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of groups that'll do that.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah. So, anyway. So, yeah, I thought this was a fun movie. It had a lot of interesting social commentary. Again, even Chris Rock, who, like I said, he just was basically Chris Rock playing, you know, his version of Rufus, he was still enjoyable to watch. Everybody was good. I love the boardroom scene at movies.
Yeah, that was one of the lesser scenes to me. I wasn't a fan.
I just like when he comes back in the room with his big gun and shoots everybody is hilarious to me.
Okay.
But, you know, again, we all bring our own bags on this trip.
Yeah, with his fecalator.
So, any other thoughts on Dogma?
No, it's not my favorite Kevin Smith movie, but, you know, it's a fine Kevin Smith movie, and it's certainly worth seeing if you haven't seen it. Of course, by now although we haven't ruined any of it, even if, you know, even if you've heard all of this, still watching it, you would find it to be a great movie. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because, you know, again, we've talked about this before with comedies, but comedy in movies is all about context. So when Absolutely. Us discussing plot points doesn't ruin the comedy. It just ruins any kind of surprise ending.
Right.
But in a movie like this, you kind of know where it's going. I mean, the world can't end, not in this kind of movie. Speaking of which, what is your favorite Kevin Smith movie?
Clerks. I mean, because there's something so just perfectly honest about Clerks, because it's such an understated movie, and there's so much in it, and there's so many layers of it, and it's just so kind of, it is so funny without trying to be too funny. And I think just in the, it was just the right time. When it came along, it was just the right time. And the characters are great in that movie. So.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a writer's movie. You know, it was yeah. well written. They, for what little budget they had, they made the most of it all because of writing and characters.
Yeah. And it was shot in black and white, which is cool. And I like the actors, you know, so, you know, it was very good.
Did you notice both the Clerks guys in this movie?
Oh yeah. No, they're all over.
Oh yeah.
So, no, it's clearly a family joint.
Did you ever see the movie Drawing Flies?
No.
Okay. Drawing Flies is I highly recommend it. It's a movie about Jason Lee and some friends go to Canada on this little trip, and it's a trip so that Jason Lee can find Bigfoot. But the movie it's an interesting movie to watch, but it's one of those movies where I watched it, I think it's barely 90 minutes long. You watch it, I would recommend watching it, okay? And then I recommend going back and watching it again with the director's commentary on, like right in a row, just the whole thing. Because it is so funny, the little things you learn from his director's commentary. I mean, because it's actually the entire cast. I think the entire cast goes in this big room and watches the movie and just talks about it. But at one point, like everybody in the cast is pretty much represented in this movie, in this room on the commentary, except for this one guy. And this one guy who plays a fairly big role in the whole thing, he never acted again. He like worked construction someplace. But at one point, I guess he had during some sort of scene where he was huddling with Jordan Ladd or something like that, he ends up, or maybe even it was Joey Lauren Adams, but he ends up like getting an erection. And so the rest of the entire movie, a lot of the commentary was, oh, look for Doug's boner or whatever. And they just kind of trash this guy mercilessly, although in a friendly way. But they were like, he was never one of their group. You know, he just kind of came in and did his lines and, you know, like kind of left, and that was it. And so they felt perfectly, you know, perfectly happy to rip on him for the rest of the movie. Plus, they also talk about how this was all a non-union movie, so a lot of the people in the movie couldn't actually be listed in the cast. And it was all, they didn't buy any permits to shoot anything. So they were just kind of, you know, they couldn't set anything up ahead of time. They couldn't block any kind of streets or anything. So they just basically walked into real businesses and roll cameras until, you know, tried to pay people a tiny little bit of money to use their convenience store or whatever.
It's so strange.
It's totally.
Whose idea was it?
No, I think it was Kevin Smith's idea, but it was just fun. And again, it wasn't. I mean, I think I got it from Sandy. It was one of those weird movies where it was put out because Kevin Smith was in a big deal.
But what's it called?
It's called Drawing Flies.
I'm writing it down. This is captivating. I know.
Yeah, well, it's okay. Did you see the movie Red State?
Not yet. It's on my list.
I recommend it.
Yeah, Travis recommended it too. It's one of those. It's on the list. It's not high on my list. It's something I need to see, but it's not compelling.
Well, think if this helps any, I don't know if it will, but I think of Red State not as a Kevin Smith movie necessarily. Don't go into it thinking about Clerks or Dogma or any of that. think about it. Think of it as a David Lynch movie.
Okay.
Because that's kind of, there's an element, there's a Lynchian element that I think you'll like.
Okay, well, possibly.
Yeah.
I have seen Cop Out.
See, I have not seen Cop Out. Is it as bad as they say?
It's a terrible movie.
Well, even he thinks so, right?
I think so. Yeah. I watched it with Mom, and I don't know why, but... I gotta say, I'm not a huge Tracy Morgan fan. Even though I'm a huge 30 Rock fan, Tracy Morgan, I just don't care for him as an actor. I just don't like him. There's not some single thing about him. I just don't like his acting style. You know, I liked him fine on Saturday Night Live. And he was okay on 30 Rock, but sitting through that movie with Mom was just some kind of purgatory.
And it's not Mom's fault.
Oh, no, no.
I was going to say, if anybody thinks for a second that we're talking about watching a movie with our mom is unpleasant, no, are you kidding? We grew up watching movies with our mom and our dad.
No, she picked it, so I blame her.
Oh, well, there you go. You're in, we are allowed. Actually, just to a little callback, remember we talked briefly about the TV show Castle?
Yeah.
I ended up watching 3 episodes of Castle today. With Mom. No, I liked it. It was my choice.
Oh, it's a great show. I think it's a fun little show. I think they jumped the shark a couple times, but no, it's a cute little show. And you know, Nathan Fillion, and it's a cutesy show.
Yeah, it's a procedural, but it's funny. It doesn't take itself too seriously, but it's got elements of being really bloody sometimes.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it falls right in with that Bones / NCIS / Law and Order kind of feel. Well, not even. Law and Order is actually more serious than the other shows are.
Yeah, this is less serious than Law and Order, but it's a fine show. Yeah. It's a B-grade show. Was she catching up on the season?
Oh no, not at all. It was actually playing on TBS, like in a block of Castle.
Oh, just like a block of like Law and Order.
Exactly, yeah. And it may not have even been TBS. It was some station. And it was because she just had her first of 2 cataract surgeries and was recovering. And so Journey and I went over there to hang out with her. And there was only so much Pocoyo that Mom wanted to watch when she was still drugged and one-eyed. So... she turned on, I can't remember what she was going to watch, and I hopefully nudged her a little bit in the, we don't have to watch this particular time in the Food Network. We can move to something else. Like, Castle looked fun. We started to watch Gotham. She really liked the first episode of Gotham, but it turned out to be way too bloody for a 4-year-old.
Yeah, I didn't record it, and I thought about Gotham, but, you know, I don't know.
Well, Journey saw Bruce Wayne's parents get shot to death, and that was kind of the end for her. She's like, this is a little scary for me, guys.
Oh, did she say that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's like, can we turn this off? This is a little scary. Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. I don't know. I want to watch it, but part of me just thinks it's going to be terrible.
Well, I can honestly say that the first 3 minutes of it were fine. And it's got Donald Logue, who we had talked about, I can't remember from which movie, but he's the guy from Terriers, the show that Drew loves.
Oh. No, I don't ring a bell.
Anyway. So, let's see.
Oh, Donald Logue. I've seen him in, what did I just watch him in?
He was a movie we did the podcast about. I can't remember if it was The Kingdom or something in that realm.
Huh.
Or maybe after that. I don't know. Dr. Strangelove actually has got a pretty good reception, by the way, from downloads.
Oh, did it?
Yeah. And again, we don't really get very big numbers at all. But, for instance, more people have downloaded Dr. Strangelove in like 3 days, then have downloaded Wag the Dog since we put that out. Yeah, so.
I think Dr. Strangelove is much more noteworthy. I'm glad that people listen to it.
Yeah. And we have much more popular movies coming up now than we did for our first three dozen movies. We should publish some form of the calendar, at least maybe a list of, hey, upcoming movies. Because, again, I do intend to put four movies on the week of Halloween. And then I intend to put four movies the week of Christmas. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.